better chance at figuring out how to capture the emissions from those fossil fuels all at the power plant, rather than having to figure out what to do with a million different tailpipes that are driving around. So you're kind of just pushing up the energy ladder. You're obviously completely right that right now most electricity still does come from fossil fuels, but it doesn't have to. And more importantly, that's going to transition over time. That's the answer. You know, we've interviewed energy experts on this, and I've spoken to them personally, and that's essentially the way it works. The transition that we need to keep pushing is for more and more electricity. And this is, by the way, the same reason that if you have an electric oven, once the electricity comes from a renewable, you've closed the loop. If you have a gas oven, no matter what, you're burning fossil fuels. And that's a lot of the reason why one of the big moves right now in renewable energy is let's start retrofitting an entire, go building by building. You put solar panels on the roof, you put in an electric heat pump, mini split type system for heating, you put in an electric oven, it's now, and you put in a car charger, and then you plug in your car. You've now gone from the roof to the garage, so to speak, on electric, and it can come from renewable energy. So that's why there's so much focus on that right now. We have a great bonus show for you today. New York, as the pandemic wanes, wants to get people riding the subway again. One of the reasons a lot of people aren't going back to the New York subways is because there are lots of people living in the subways, and there are more incidents of sucker punches and people being pushed in front of trains that are being reported on. I don't know if it's happening more, but it's being reported on it more. And New York City wants to deal with that. But how are they going to deal with that? Is it going to be oppressive? We're going to talk about that. Number two, Democrats have again introduced a bill to eliminate these tax subsidies when sports teams build new stadiums. Maybe will it pass this time? We will discuss. And we have a new study that claims that when there are stand your ground laws enacted, homicides go up 11%. Not justifiable uses of guns for self-defense. Legal homicides, illegal homicides, go up 11%. We're going to talk about that on the bonus show. All of those stories and more are at your fingertips when you sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the code WOW22 on our website to get a discount.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, in sound, from way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a once-over.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey,
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
To start in Europe what could be the worst war since the beginning of the century.
Russia has launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine by attacking it from the north, east, and south, prompting widespread condemnation and the threat of new sanctions. Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered the invasion early this morning from Moscow.
I decided to conduct a special military operation. It aims to protect people who have been bullied and subjected to genocide by the Kiev regime for 8 years.
We'll get the latest on the Russian invasion, then look at the looming humanitarian crisis in Ukraine with Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Plus, we speak with former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis of the Progressive International about what the Russian invasion means for Europe. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's military has launched an invasion of Ukraine. Overnight explosions rock the capital, Kyiv, with reports of shelling, missile strikes, and gunfire across Ukraine, which has also come under an intense cyber attack. Ukraine's government says some 40 Ukrainian soldiers and 10 civilians have been killed so far, including 18 reportedly killed in a missile attack on Ukraine's southern Odessa region. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has declared martial law, saying his government will hand out weapons to everyone who's willing and able to defend Ukraine's sovereignty. The invasion came just moments after Russian President Vladimir Putin said in a nationally televised address he'll intervene to help pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk regions.
I decided to conduct a special military operation. It aims to protect people who have been bullied and subjected to genocide by the Kiev regime for 8 years. For that, we will strive for demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine and will bring to justice those who committed multiple bloody crimes against civilians, including Russian citizens.
Russia's invasion began as the United Nations Security Council met in an emergency session last night to discuss tensions in Ukraine. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned Russia's aggression as, quote, the saddest moment in my tenure, he said.
President Putin, in the name of humanity, bring your troops back to Russia. In the name of humanity, do not allow to start in Europe what could be the worst war since the beginning of the century.
President Biden's meeting with G7 counterparts today to map out more severe measures against Russia, including new sanctions. In Paris, officials lit up City Hall overnight with the blue and yellow colors of Ukraine's flag. In Berlin, German officials lit the Brandenburg Gate in similar fashion. After headlines, we'll have the latest on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the world's response. The drug makers Sanofi and GSK said on Wednesday they'll request emergency use authorization for their COVID-19 vaccine from European and U.S. regulators. The companies say the Sanofi-GSK vaccine showed 100% efficacy at preventing severe disease and hospitalization in a late-stage clinical trial and 58% efficacy against symptomatic disease. Sanofi and GSK received billions of dollars from Operation Warp Speed, the Trump administration's initiative to fast-track vaccine development. The World Health Organization says it's opening a global biomanufacturing hub in South Korea to train people in low- and middle-income countries to produce vaccines and therapeutics used to fight COVID. The WHO also said Wednesday it'll transfer technology from its South African mRNA vaccine hub to five more countries: Bangladesh, Indonesia, Pakistan, Serbia, and Vietnam. The WHO has produced a prototype COVID vaccine based on technology reverse engineered from Moderna's mRNA shot, but the vaccine could still take more than a year to test and develop. Top WHO scientist Dr. Soumya Swaminathan said Wednesday Moderna and Pfizer could help rapidly speed up the process by sharing their patented technologies with the world.
We would very much welcome a partnership with them because, as we were describing, you know, the development from scratch of a vaccine does take time, which means that it's not going to be really available as a vaccine that before the end of 23 or more likely 2024. This timeline can obviously be shortened considerably if a known technology, a known vaccine with proven efficacy and safety were to transfer their know-how.
Two prosecutors at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office who were leading the criminal probe into Donald Trump's business dealings have resigned. The investigation started under former Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance, but sources say the new DA, Alvin Bragg, has expressed doubt over an indictment of Trump, which may have led to the prosecutor's resignation. The term of the grand jury impaneled in the case expires in April. A caravan of truckers demanding an end to coronavirus public health measures has left California on a cross-country drive to Washington, D.C. The convoy of about two dozen trucks set out from the Mojave Desert Wednesday after several hundred people attended a rally that resembled a Trump campaign event. Organizers of the convoy have ties to the violent January 6th Capitol insurrection. They're modeling the U.S. convoy on protests in Canada that closed border crossings and disrupted activity in the capital, Ottawa, for weeks. On Wednesday, the Pentagon authorized the deployment of about 700 unarmed National Guard members to Washington, D.C. during upcoming protests. At least two district attorneys from Texas's largest counties say they will refuse to comply with an order by Republican Governor Greg Abbott to investigate gender-affirming health care for transgender youth as child abuse. Abbott's directive to state agencies says parents of trans children receiving the often life-saving care should be investigated and that anyone, including doctors, nurses, and teachers, who fails to report the treatment to authorities could face criminal liability. Medical groups, rights groups, and families slammed Texas's latest attack on LGBTQ plus youth. Last year, Texas joined other Republican-led states in banning transgender youth from participating in school sports. Earlier this month, South Dakota's Republican governor, Kristi Noem, signed a similar law for South Dakotan trans athletes. She came under fire this week when she refused to acknowledge how anti-trans legislation is impacting her own constituents.
There is a statistic circulating around right now that 90% of South Dakota's LGBTQ community is diagnosed with either anxiety or depression. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. That makes me sad, and we should figure it out.
Meanwhile, Florida's new anti-LGBTQ education bill, known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, has advanced in the State House and is scheduled for a final vote in the Florida House today. The bill would ban discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. In Kentucky, opening arguments kicked off Wednesday in the trial of former Louisville police officer Brett Hankison, who fired 10 shots during a botched no-knock police raid that killed Breonna Taylor in her own home. Hankison is charged with wanton endangerment for hitting Taylor's neighbor's apartment during the raid. Prosecutors will have to convince a jury that Hankison acted with extreme indifference to life. This is Assistant Attorney General Barbara Whaley.
And you will hear that his bullets went through apartment 4 into apartment 3 and nearly hit Cody Etherton as he was walking down the hallway into the dining room of his apartment to see what was going on with the banging.
And a warning to our viewers, this next story contains graphic footage. In Haiti, one journalist was killed and others injured after police opened fire on a demonstration of factory workers in Port-au-Prince demanding living wages. On Monday, Haiti's government announced a minimum wage increase of up to 54% following weeks of demonstrations and amid soaring inflation. But striking garment workers say that even with the pay rise, their salary is still just half or less of the roughly $15 per day they're demanding.
Once again, we've taken to the streets to protest the wage adjustment of $1.70 because we do not accept it. In the letters we've sent to Prime Minister Ariel Henry, we have demanded $14 and social benefits. We've been to four meetings without reaching a solution.
Garment workers in Haiti make clothes and sweatshop conditions for major U.S. brands, including Gap, Walmart, Target, and for Canada's Gildan activewear. Madagascar has been hit by a major tropical storm for the fourth time in just the last month. Cyclone Emnati crashed ashore on Madagascar's southeastern coast Wednesday, bringing sustained 85-mile-an-hour winds that ripped the roofs off houses and caused flooding. About 200 people have been killed by cyclones in Madagascar so far this year. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy has finalized plans to purchase a fleet of gasoline-powered postal delivery trucks in a move that defies the Biden administration's pledge to acquire zero-emissions vehicles. A 10-year deal worth up to $10 billion would see the Oshkosh Defense Corporation provide as many as 165,000 gas-powered postal vehicles produced with non-union labor in South Carolina. The group Earth Justice responded in a statement, quote, DeJoy's plans for the postal fleet will drag us back decades with a truck model that gets laughable fuel economy. We may as well deliver the mail with Hummers, unquote. Louis DeJoy was appointed as Postmaster General under former President Trump. He's a longtime Republican mega donor and infamously caused widespread delays at USPS in the run-up to the 2020 election when mail-in ballots played a major role. And the Biden administration's open bidding on new offshore wind development rights, attracting a record-setting $1.5 billion of sales on Wednesday alone. That's more than triple the previous U.S. record for a wind auction set in 2018. The new leases cover areas off the coasts of New York and New Jersey and could one day provide power to nearly 2 million homes. Some coastal communities have objected to offshore wind, citing falling property values and concerns over local ecosystems. Other environmentalists, like the New Jersey League of Conservation voters, welcome wind power as a path toward cleaner energy.
The greatest threat to our oceans is not windmills. The greatest threat to our oceans is climate change. The temperatures of our oceans are rising. The ocean is acidifying. Our coral reefs are dying and bleaching. We're losing species by the day. We can stop that. Wind will help us to reduce our carbon pollution.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Russia's launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine from the north, east, and south. Shelling and missile strikes have been reported in cities across Ukraine, which has also come under an intense cyber attack. Ukrainian officials say Russia's fired cruise and ballistic missiles at military installations and airfields near Kyiv. Video has emerged at one apartment complex that sustained heavy damage after being shelled. The Russian invasion began just moments after Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special operation in Ukraine. The invasion comes just days after Putin recognized two breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine as independent states. Putin, who oversees the world's largest nuclear arsenal, warned in his speech, quote, "No one should have any doubts that a direct attack on our country will lead to the destruction and horrible consequences for any potential aggressor," Putin said. He ordered the invasion just as the United Nations Security Council was meeting in New York to discuss the crisis. In a statement, President Biden said, quote, "President Putin has chosen a premeditated war that will bring a catastrophic loss of life and human suffering." President Biden is expected to speak today at noon about the Russian invasion. The U.S. and allies are vowing a new round of sanctions against Russia. Earlier today, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg condemned Russia's invasion.
Russia has attacked Ukraine. This is a brutal act of war. Our thoughts are with the brave people of Ukraine. Sadly, what we have warned against for months has come to pass. Despite all calls on Russia to change course and tireless efforts to seek a diplomatic solution, peace on our continent has been shattered. We now have war in Europe on a scale and of a type we thought belonged to history.
Ukraine has said at least 40 Ukrainian soldiers and around 10 civilians have been killed in the early hours of the invasion. Ukraine is also claiming it's downed 7 Russian planes and 2 helicopters. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky vowed Ukraine will resist the Russian invasion.
The Ukrainian armed forces were involved in heavy fighting, repelling attacks in Donbass and other regions, east, north, south. The enemy sustained serious losses, and the enemy will sustain many more losses. They came on our land. We are already handing out weapons and will hand them out to defend our country to everyone who wants and has the capacity to defend our sovereignty. The future of Ukraine depends on every citizen.
Thousands of Ukrainians are fleeing the country. These are the voices of 2 Ukrainians who crossed into Poland earlier today.
Feeling when at the middle of the night you are awake because everybody calls you that the bomb fell and there is fires everywhere and different places, even such were supposed not to be bombed, even Western Ukraine, right?
Really, we are feeling bad because it was unexpected, and we all want peace and quiet. We don't want war, please, like, stop, because people suffer from it, and we must go out of the country because we have, like, no other choice.
We begin our show today with Anatol Levin, senior fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, author of numerous books on Russia and the former Soviet republics, including Ukraine and Russia, A Fraternal Rivalry. Well, this has certainly gone beyond fraternal, Anatol Levin. Can you respond to the invasion, the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
We have to, obviously absolutely unequivocally condemn it. I mean, condemn both the invasion, but also the justifications given by President Putin for the invasion in his speech. I'm reminded of U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull's response to the Japanese memorandum which accompanied the attack on Pearl Harbor. He said that in all his 50 years of public life, he had never read a document so packed with infamous lies. I think that pretty much sums up Putin's speech as well.
I want to go to a clip of Putin giving his address on the rationale for attacking the Ukraine.
The People's Republic of Donbass asked Russia for help in this regard under Article 51, Part 7 of the Charter of the United Nations, with the approval of the Russian State Federal Council, in accordance with the Friendship and Mutual Assistance Treaties with the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic, ratified by the Russian Parliament on February 22nd. I decided to conduct a special military operation. It aims to protect people who have been bullied and subjected to genocide by the Kiev regime for 8 years. For that, we will strive for demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine and will bring to justice those who committed multiple bloody crimes against civilians, including Russian citizens.
So that's President Putin. Anatol Levin, his reasons for going into Ukraine, demilitarization and denazification. Can you explain what he's talking about?
He is obviously aiming first to prevent, as Russia indeed has been demanding for many, many years now, that Ukraine not form an alliance with the West. So that's the demilitarization part. Of course, in the process, he clearly now intends to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces. And denazification, now, I mean, this is terribly sinister because it implies that he is going to attempt to destroy Ukrainian nationalism and by one means or another to eliminate, Ukrainian political parties that Russia sees as anti-Russian nationalist parties. Well, that, if carried through, implies extremely ferocious repression in the areas controlled by Russia.
Have you been shocked by what's taken place?
I was not shocked by the invasion itself, because that has been clearly building for months now. I hoped that there would still be more time given for an attempt at a diplomatic compromise, but I think the Russian government decided that the West was simply not not prepared to offer that. So I wasn't shocked by the invasion. I mean, what has shocked me has been the Putin's language in his speech and what it implies, and also the fact that it would seem — this isn't certain yet, but Russian forces appear to have invaded not just in the eastern and southern parts of the country where Russian speaking population is concentrated, but they may have also invaded from the north, heading for Kiev. Now, if that is the case, then the Russian intention is obviously to take over the whole of Ukraine and replace the government in Kiev. Now, together with this talk of denazification, I mean, that if this is actually what Russia is aiming at. And, one always has to be cautious because, the phrase the fog of war, obviously in the initial stages of any conflict, it's very difficult to say for sure what's happening. But clearly, if the intention is to take over the whole of Ukraine, including Kiev, and suppress Ukrainian nationalism, I mean, the implications of this for what's going to happen in Ukraine are truly, truly appalling.
And can you talk about the political spectrum in Ukraine? I mean, you've got neo-Nazi paramilitaries, but you also have a president who's Jewish, Zelensky.
Well, yes. I mean, look, there are indeed fascistic parties and groups in Ukraine. I mean, that's true as far as it goes. And indeed, they have had disproportionate influence, and I think it's legitimate to blame the West for not having condemned these groups more strongly and, done more to put pressure on the Ukrainian government to suppress them. But equally, accusing the Ukrainian government itself and accusing President Zelensky of being some kind of Nazi and accusing the Ukrainian state of genocide, I mean, these are monstrous lies on the part of Putin.
What about the role of Belarus, Anatole? Although Belarus is insisting they have not sent soldiers with the Russian soldiers coming from the north, they are clearly a launching ground.
Well, yes, and I think, I mean, what this demonstrates is the fact that President Lukashenko, who previously tried to maintain a certain distance from Russia, while being a partner, but also trying to stress Belarus's independence. And Lukashenko has had serious problems with Putin over the years. But I think that, when the protests against Lukashenko's regime erupted in recent years and the West, threw its weight completely behind the Belarusian opposition. Lukashenko has decided that his only hope of the survival of his regime is to be allied as closely as possible with Russia. And, of course, that implies doing whatever Russia wants, including allowing Belarus to be used as a base to invade Ukraine.
There are reports of explosions being heard as far as Odessa on the Black Sea. Can you talk about the significance of this, Anton?
Well, it's clear from the distribution of Russian air and missile attacks that the intention is to knock out the Ukrainian Air Force and Navy, and as much as possible of Ukraine's military forces all over the country. In other words, this is the classic opening stage of an invasion. Now, what is not clear yet is how far the Russian ground invasion will go, because obviously that's quite a different matter from from knocking out the Ukrainian Air Force. And there, so far, in the case of Odessa, for example, the reports have been contradictory. Initially, there were reports of Russian landings. Then that was denied. We will have to see. I think it would be wrong to make any categorical statements at this point about the military situation on the ground, because, as I say, we're in the classic state of the fog of war. It's not clear exactly what is happening.
President Biden is going to make a national address today. What do you want to hear him say?
Well, it's absolutely obvious that he and European governments as well have to introduce the toughest possible sanctions, economic sanctions, against Russia. There can be no question of that now whatsoever. And obviously must move in every international forum to condemn and isolate Russia diplomatically. It will be interesting to see now how countries which in the past have sided with Russia against Western interventionism will now react to this Russian invasion of Ukraine. I mean, my sense is that it will receive overwhelming international condemnation, quite rightly. And perhaps that even the Chinese, while I think that for their obvious strategic reasons they will support Russia economically, I think even the Chinese will be cautious about trying to support or justify this invasion politically and diplomatically. For many years now, Russia and other countries have appealed to international law against the West, over the invasion of Iraq, the overthrow of the Libyan state, and so forth. Well, now this is such an absolutely flagrant violation of the most basic, international laws and the rules and principles of the United Nations that, unless China and other countries are going to be willing to look totally hypocritical, they have to denounce this.
Anatole Levin, a bipartisan group of House members, said, quote, "The American people, through their representatives in Congress, deserve to have a say before U.S. troops are placed in harm's way or the U.S. becomes involved in yet another foreign conflict." Your response?
Well, President Biden and all the NATO governments and NATO itself have said that U.S. troops won't be sent there. And this was underlined by the withdrawal of Western diplomats, the withdrawal of U.S. and other military observers and trainers as well. So I don't think that the U.S. representatives need to worry too much about that. Now, I do have to say that the obvious, refusal of the West to defend Ukraine. I mean, while it is completely justified because, A, we don't have the troops in Europe to do this, and B, it would obviously risk the nuclear annihilation of mankind. But we do have to ask, I'm afraid, this may not be the right moment, but at some stage we do have to ask, why, if we were not prepared to fight to defend Ukraine, we offered NATO membership to Ukraine? NATO membership implies
explicitly a willingness to defend NATO members. If we weren't going to defend Ukraine, why did we tell them they could become members of NATO?
But, I mean, have they been told that? I mean, isn't that the key issue right now?
Well, I mean, you know, since 2008, America and Britain have pressed for NATO membership for Ukraine, and NATO as a whole has said that the door is open to Ukraine to join in future. That, after all, was the principal Russian demand at the start of this crisis.
Let me ask you a quick final question, because I know you have to go, Anatol. Putin said no one should have any doubts that a direct attack on our country will lead to the destruction and horrible consequences for any potential aggressor, the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. What do you think he's saying?
Well, he's saying just that, that if NATO goes to war with Russia, Russia is prepared to use nuclear weapons. That is why NATO is not going to go to war with Russia. But we should have thought of that before.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Anatol Lieven is a fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's the author of numerous books on Russia and the former Soviet republics, including Ukraine and Russia, A Fraternal Rivalry. Next up, we look at the looming humanitarian crisis in Ukraine with Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council, who's just back from Ukraine. He'll speak to us from Oslo. Stay with us. Solovey by the Ukrainian electro folk band Go A. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we turn now to the humanitarian implications of what could become the largest war in Europe since World War II. We go now to Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, recently in eastern Ukraine, but he's joining us now from Oslo, Norway. Jan, welcome back to Democracy Now! Humanitarian groups like yours have warned of a major crisis for millions of people in Ukraine. You're just back from there. What are your concerns?
Well, what is unfolding now is the ugliest of scenarios. A cruel military onslaught is now engulfing millions, especially in the east along this front line that is going straight through the communities of Luhansk and Donetsk, but also from the north, from the south, there are military attacks. So hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians will now be displaced, and millions are actually now in some kind of a crossfire. It couldn't be worse.
What was your response last night, early this morning, as the invasion unfolded, as the UN Secretary, as the UN Security Council was meeting?
Well, I was woken up very, very early this morning because of the reports from my colleagues, the aid workers in the field in Ukraine. And of course, it was disbelief because nobody thought that the world would be so senseless, that there would be an attack of this size, an invasion. It will lead to untold suffering in Ukraine, but also refugee flows in the region as such. People will flee to Poland, to Hungary, Romania, Moldova, to Russia. There is also a lot of suffering in the self-declared so-called republics in the east. These are people who will flee to Russia. They have unleashed something that will have untold consequences, untold suffering.
So you also have this movement, for example, of U.S. troops from Italy moving up, landing in Latvia. You've got the situation in Poland. Now there has to be deconfliction because you could have NATO forces coming face to face with Russian forces. Can you explain that to lay people, what that means?
Well, of course, deconfliction is something we're also doing as humanitarians. It's basically that anyone tells the other opposing side where they are. We have deconflicted our sides now with the Russians and with the Ukrainian army. They know where there are humanitarian sites. They will not be attacked, we hope and believe. But listen, the story is the civilian suffering. The people who are engulfed by this fighting, who are in crossfire, are to a large extent elderly people. These are pensioners that are living on a meager minus pension, or their widows. I was in outposts along the front line just 2 weeks ago. One of these places, Opitne, there were 37 souls. Average age must have been 75 years in this place. Several said, we're sick. They have cancerous, husbands, cannot move. I'm thinking of them now. They are bearing the brunt of this suffering that was unleashed by people who sit in heated offices in the Kremlin and elsewhere and do not understand the suffering that they are causing.
Can you talk about the possibility of this getting, I mean, as if Ukraine isn't difficult enough, so much broader? Do you think, for example, your neighbors, Finland, Sweden, would possibly consider, their leaders are saying no at this point, but consider joining NATO as a result of this, Putin strengthening NATO, as opposed to what he would like to see, which is to abolish it? And there are many peace activists in the world who would also like to see that.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of people saying Europe has changed overnight. What I hope is that instead of a continued escalation, continued military escalation, and a willingness to use untold billions of rubles and now also billions of dollars on military escalation, that there will be an escalation, a surge of diplomatic action. I cannot believe that people are so senseless that they will take themselves and their people down in this. I think there is still a hope for a ceasefire, that there will be also investment in the humanitarian operation. Because, Amy, we had 9% of the funding for the ongoing humanitarian operation before the invasion. Now that needs have grown tenfold. Will we get the funding we need to provide for those who flee? I don't know. I hope we will at least get a fraction of what the militaries so easily are getting now across the world.
So the U.S. has just pulled out of Afghanistan. You have warned of the devastation of this country after decades of war. I'm talking about Afghanistan. And now we are seeing Ukraine. Can you make some comparisons here and where the world's wealth should be going as billions are now being poured into this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, first, we're really overstretched. I cannot remember in my 40 years as a humanitarian worker a period where we were as overstretched as we are now. The Afghan mega crisis, the Syrian mega crisis, the Yemeni mega crisis, the Congo, the Sahel, and so on. And now, on top of that, this meaningless war in Ukraine that will affect millions, not hundreds of thousands, many millions. Now, of course, it's Europe, so I think some of those countries who will receive refugees would have resources to care for the people. This is not Afghanistan, where people lost the $1 a day they were surviving on. But there will be also a lot of suffering here, and there has really not been investment in humanitarian operations in Ukraine. That's why the preparedness is not as good as it should have been to meet new waves of displacement. My colleagues on the ground are telling about panic, about disbelief, of fear. People do not know what to do, where to flee, how to get out of harm's way. Many of our colleagues on the ground have relatives, parents on the other side of the front lines. These are now divided societies.
What do you think has to happen now, Jan?
Well, we're still saying it's not too late to end this before the millions start to flee. What I hope is that there is a ceasefire. Listen, is it naive? I hope not. We cannot accept this thing becoming, as people are saying, the biggest war in the history of Europe since the Second World War. Why does it have to come to that? And if it comes to that, we would all live to regret it. So there has to be urgent phone calls to President Putin and saying, stop it. It can be stopped. I don't think the sanctions will stop this short term. It is diplomatic initiatives that could stop this short term.
In Norway right now, the place where the Nobel Peace Prize is given out, what is the response to what's taking place right now? And what would you like to see? I'll ask you the same question I asked Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute just a minute ago. President Biden's addressing the nation today. The UN is a powerful force right now in the response to Russia and what's happening in Ukraine. What do you want him to say?
I hope he'll say, I'm going to call Putin today to talk with him directly. They talk to each other now through the international media. It's not good. I hope that President Biden will also be leading in a forceful humanitarian response. Humanitarians being underfunding, militaries having a lot of hardware. I hope there will be a maybe also reaching out to China and others that can influence Russia. Diplomacy must be on the first actor here, along with us humanitarians. We're not leaving Ukraine. We are there. We will remain and stay and deliver in the hour of greatest need of Ukrainians. We also need help. In Norway, of course, we've lived with Russia as a neighbor in the far north, a good neighbor now, every single day since they withdrew the Red Army when the Nazis were beaten in 1945. So in our neighborhood, we have good relations. There has to be the same understanding that war is something of the past, shouldn't happen in Europe, in Ukraine, in 2020.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Oslo, Norway. Next up, we go to Greece to speak with the former finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, of the Progressive International, about what the Russian invasion means for Europe. Stay with us. Requiem for Peace Prelude, Leaving Russia, composed by Larry Nickel, performed by the University of British Columbia School of Music. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we go to Greece to see what this means for the continent of Europe. We're joined now by Yanis Varoufakis, member of the Greek Parliament, former finance minister of Greece, latest book titled Another Now. He's also founder of Progressive International with Senator Bernie Sanders. Yanis, welcome back to Democracy Now! Your response as you saw what unfolded over the last hours with this broad Russian invasion of Ukraine?
What can I say? It's a dark, bleak day for the world, for Europe in particular. War is back on the continent that was promised by our European Union that war would never be back on our soil. Vladimir Putin is to blame entirely for taking this step, but at the same time, NATO must be condemned for creating the circumstances leading to Putin's escapade in the Ukraine. We have to stop this war right now, and we have to work very hard to stop any NATO escalation. We have to create international solidarity in order to ensure that the people of Ukraine live in peace, not under the boot of any army, and for NATO to keep out of Europe, and especially Eastern Europe, as, let's not forget, George Bush, senior George Bush, had promised Mikhail Gorbachev.
What should be the European Union response? The EU has promised unprecedented sanctions, holding an emergency summit in Brussels. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said sanctions will target strategic sectors of the Russian economy by blocking the access to technologies and markets that are key for Russia. And if approved, will, quote, weaken Russia's economic base, its capacity to modernize. She said, in addition, will freeze Russian assets in the European Union and stop the access of Russian banks to European financial markets. Your response?
Believe me, Amy, that Putin is not trembling in his boots listening to all this. Allow me to preface my answer by saying that the European Union is the greatest loser from what's happening, apart, of course, from the people in the Ukraine who are suffering the slings and arrows of war. The European Union is discredited. It has failed completely in its mission, which is to keep our eastern flank free of war. And now what we have is essentially adopting the NATO language as if the European Union is simply an appendage of NATO. And also huge amounts of hypocrisy. You mentioned all those threats of great sanctions. It's like, you know, a peace shooter trying to stop a tank because there is one sanction that could work, one sanction that Putin fears, and that is ending the purchases of natural gas from Gazprom. As we speak, Nord Stream 1 is a gas pipeline, is feeding the German industrial machine with 40% of its energy from Russian gas. They're not going to say anything about that because this is a sanction they're not prepared to make. And it, therefore, we have this combination of diplomatic atrophy and hypocrisy.
What about the possibility of this escalating into a nuclear war? You have the very ominous threat of President Putin, who oversees the world's largest nuclear arsenal, saying in his speech, no one should have any doubts that a direct attack on our country will lead to the destruction and horrible consequences for any potential aggressor. You have the major nuclear power plants in Ukraine. We already know what happened with Chernobyl. That was when it was part of the Soviet Union. But the possibility of one of these plants being hit or workers not going to work out of fear or a cyber attack on them, what it could mean, possibly another Chernobyl. How do we deal with this around the world?
Well, when the beast of war is unleashed from its lair, then all sorts of catastrophes are possible. I don't believe that Putin or the United States are planning to go that far, but you never know, because this is the great uncertainty that is liberated the moment the hawks begin to fly menacingly, you know, over the heads of European peoples and peoples all over the world. The number one priority now is for a serious diplomatic initiative that sorts this mess out by giving Putin something that he can present the Russian people with as a victory. And that's something that would not have any costs for anybody around the world, would be for a declaration by NATO, by the United States, that Ukraine will not become a member of NATO in exchange for troop withdrawal from the side of Vladimir Putin, that he takes back his, that he stops, seizes all hostilities and removes all troops from Ukrainian soil. I believe that that would be potentially the foundation for a peace deal that would be in the interest of humanity, not just of the Ukrainians. Both sides need to take a step back. Of course, the major step back must be Putin's, but the United States, and I'm mentioning the United States because the European Union is non-existent, it has rendered itself non-existent. The United States has to make a deal that involves a kind of neutrality for the Ukraine. The United States is never going to say troops, send troops to Ukraine, will never prevent Putin from trampling upon the rights and lives of the Ukrainians, at least declare that and make this part of the bargaining process by which the people of the Ukraine will be liberated from Russian troops.
Let me ask you about the role of the UN. I want to play the speech of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking last night at the United Nations Security Council in New York.
This is the saddest moment in my tenure as Secretary General of the United Nations. I started this meeting of the Security Council addressing President Putin and telling him from the bottom of my heart, stop your troops from an offensive to the Ukraine, give peace a chance, because too many people have already died. During the meeting, President Putin announced a special military operation in the Donbas and required the Ukrainian troops to lay down their arms. So in the present circumstances, I must change my appeal. And I must say, President Putin, in the name of humanity, bring your troops back to Russia. In the name of humanity, do not allow to start in Europe what could be the worst war since the beginning of the century. What is clear for me is that this war doesn't make any sense. It violates the principles of the Charter, and it causes, or will cause, if it doesn't stop, a level of suffering Europe has not known since at least the Balkanic crisis.
That is the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking last night at the UN Security Council, an emergency meeting that was called as Russia then began the invasion of Ukraine. Yanis Varoufakis, your response to his comments, do you think the UN has any more power than what you're saying is now an eviscerated European Union?
But not. Antonio Guterres made a moving speech, a good speech. But he mentioned the Charter of the United Nations and the need to respect it. Well, There's no doubt that Putin is not respecting it. And we should do our utmost to make sure that he does respect it, or that he pays the price for not respecting it. But at the same time, let's not forget, Amy, we are old enough to remember how the United Nations Charter was absolutely violated, turned into a piece of paper with no value whatsoever by George W. Bush when he invaded Iraq without any permission or any due process involving the United Nations. Even before that, in 1999, NATO bombarded Yugoslavia, and the Clinton administration back then dismissed the United Nations, bypassed the United Nations, effectively rendered it inoperative. So the United Nations is a fine idea. Internationalism is the only way forward. But I'm afraid that Antonio Guterres is, the chief in an empty tent.
I'm looking at a tweet from New York Times reporter. Anti-war solo pickets like this are popping up in cities across Russia. It's not much, but they're arrested almost immediately, often upon leaving their homes when the cops know to expect them. Here's Sofia Rusova, co-chair of Russia's Trade Union of Journalists, and a handful of anti-war protesters has gathered outside of Ukraine's embassy in Moscow, and they're arrested. What about the population inside Russia? Who stands to gain from this and who loses? In fact, won't the sanctions strengthen the hand, even though some of Russia's billionaires are targeted by the sanctions? If they're cut off from the rest of the economy outside, it is those billionaires' businesses inside that Russia will have to depend on.
Well, I'm ever so glad that you mentioned the anti-war movement within Russia, because our best comrades, our best friends and collaborators in bringing about peace are the Democrats in Russia, the Democrats in China, the Democrats in the United States of America, small d Democrats. I'm not referring to the ruling party. And it is always important that we ask ourselves the question, whenever we do something or suggest something or propose a policy, what effect is this going to have on the Democrats in Russia? And I very much fear that the West is behaving as if with the sole purpose in mind to strengthen Putin against the Democrats in Russia. Because when you encircle Russia with NATO troops and NATO nuclear weapons, you are giving Putin very powerful arguments within Russia to effectively continue the oppression of Democrats in Russia. This war is the result, on the one hand, of NATO expansionism, and on the other hand, of course, crucially, the great glee with which Putin grabs the opportunity that the United States and NATO and Europe give him to have this war in order to enhance his authority, his brutal, cruel authority, over the good people, the good Democrats of Russia.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Yanis Varoufakis, for joining us. We're hoping also to be joined by a peace activist from Ukraine, but he had to make his way into a war underground shelter in Kiev. I also want to say about the peace movement in the United States, I know that Code Pink has Saturday called for an emergency rally online to demand no war in Ukraine. I think it's particularly important for the corporate media to pay attention. They're going to be featuring peace activists from the U.S., U.K., Ukraine, Russia, Germany, France. How important it is to hear those voices as well. Yanis Varoufakis, member of the Greek Parliament, former finance minister of Greece, founder of the Progressive International with Senator Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Has job openings. Our human resources manager will learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nirmin Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Eric Harrison enjoying some whiskey before breakfast with Mando Richard. Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Drink up, Yinzers.
Everybody ready?
Are you ready for whiskey before breakfast? I am. Hey everybody, thanks so much for tuning in to Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, or Tube City Online Radio from McKeesport, Pennsylvania. I am Amanda Richard, and we've got quite the busy show for you. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family, have a set or two of totally eclectic music, do a bunch of love songs since Valentine's Day happens this month, and we'll close down on the gospel side of the family like we usually do. You know, I think we better get started right away. Here come Mile 12, and they are on the Whiskey Trail. Thanks for tuning in.
Maybe there's a place where the good man go. Maybe it's a place that I won't know. I'm headed down that whiskey trail. Mama told me not to run because I'm at fault. Never was the kind of listen my child home. I'm headed down that whiskey trail. Well, damn that old whiskey trail. Daddy drank his dinner from a paper sack. Made it out the door and they never came back. Headed down that whiskey trail. They say that I'm a cheap right off the sun.
A little spicy hot.